This is Deborah Beck, professor of ancient Greek literature in the Department of Classics at the University of Texas at Austin. My students and I are excited to welcome you to our podcast, Musings in Greek Literature. This is Deborah Beck, the instructor of the advanced Greek students who've been producing such terrific work for our class podcast series, Sophocles' Antigone, in 2019. For the title of our last episode, I'm borrowing Aristotle's term exodos, which is what he uses to designate the part of a Greek tragedy that happens after the final choral ode. I'm going to take most of this episode to talk about various aspects of the exodos of the play, but at the end, I'll talk a little bit about what I've learned about teaching and learning. I've certainly enjoyed my students' insights into the play, both in their teaching and in their podcasts, but I think probably my single favorite part of listening to their work has been to get a glimpse of what it looks like and feels like to be the teacher for someone that isn't a teacher every single day like I am. I've really learned a lot about my own teaching from seeing teaching through the eyes of my students, and I'm hoping that I'm going to be able to put that to good use in my future classes. So to review, in episode 14, our final student-produced podcast, Tarek brought us up to the entrance of Tiresias, and this is where things really start to fall apart for Creon. Tiresias gives Creon a horrible-sounding prophecy that his own house will soon fall into ruin because of the way that he's treated Polynices and Antigone. As long as Tiresias is still there, Creon seems totally unwilling to take in anything he says. But then, after Tiresias leaves the stage under the impression that he's had no effect on Creon at all, the chorus is finally able to persuade Creon to release Antigone and bury the corpse of Polynices. Then the chorus sings their last song, a short hymn to Dionysus, in which they praise him under many names and attributes and ask him to free Thebes from its plague. They sound very hopeful and optimistic about things getting better now that Creon has finally changed his mind about Antigone and Polynices. But as soon as they finish their song, things take a major turn for the worse. The rest of the play is one long howl of bereavement and despair. Creon's downfall hits even harder because of the brief glimpse of a different, happier ending that we can get from the chorus's upbeat song. What if things really had turned out the way the chorus seems to think they're going to? What would that have been like? But as soon as the chorus's song ends, a messenger arrives. When the chorus asks him, in verse 1172, what new burden, achthos, are you bringing? The messenger tells his entire story, and in fact the entire story of the play, in just one verse. Tethnasin, hoide zontes aitioi thanein, he says. They are dead, and the living are to blame for their dying. The chiastic structure of this verse, which brackets the living in the middle, with two forms of the verb die at the beginning and end, brings the living and the dead into the same close yet mutually exclusive relationship that we've seen all through the play. Antigone, the central character, is in an important sense dead while she's still alive. She talks about herself as being dead, and so do the other characters. While various dead characters, especially Polynices, continue to have a major effect on the lives of the survivors. As this dialogue between the chorus and the messenger continues, Creon's wife Eurydice overhears what they're saying and comes out onto the stage to learn more. Even though Eurydice is one of the smallest, shortest roles in all of extant Greek tragedy, Mark Griffith points out that her presence makes the messenger's speech unusually rich and complex because of the many different audiences that it encompasses. Within the speech, the messenger describes the reactions of Creon, his servants, and Haemon to the discovery of Antigone's corpse and Haemon's suicide. On stage, the chorus and Eurydice, in very different ways, digest this news. Haemon's mother first learns of the death of her son right there on the stage, in front of everyone. And this adds a further layer of grief and horror to the terrible scene that the messenger describes. Then, when Eurydice learns the truth, She silently goes back into the house, and after a while, the chorus says, "Wait, what happened to Eurydice? Where'd she go?" Our class was not able to finish reading the play in Greek, and instead, we spent part of our final class period watching a performance of the last 200 verses of the play on video. Although the very, very lousy subtitles of the video made some of the performance into an unintentional comedy, you could have heard a pin drop during the messenger's speech. It was a great reminder, for me at least, of the truth of the cliche that what you don't see is far scarier than what gets put on the stage. So too, Eurydice's silent exit in the middle of the messenger's speech is a far more eloquent response to the news that her son Haemon is dead than any speech could ever be. After Creon fails to rescue Antigone in time and Haemon takes his own life beside her, Creon returns to the stage at verse 1261. From here until nearly the end of the play, he and the chorus engage in an emotional lyric dialogue, a kamos, about his stupefying bereavement. The jagged, irregular lengths of the verses and the emotionally intense dachmiak meter make the very structure of this kamos highly expressive. We don't really have a modern analogy for how emotionally powerful the shape of this dialogue with the chorus is before we even get to what anyone actually says. I think this is one of the places in the Antigone where it's especially important to think of opera rather than spoken drama as the closest modern analogy to ancient Greek tragedy. But at the same time, what Creon says is strikingly emotional and intense. A whole podcast episode would be necessary to scratch the surface of that topic, so I just want to look at how Sophocles uses the word child to bring to life the existential despair of losing a child. 5 times in the last 200 verses of the play, the word technon, etymologically related to the verb tikto, which means to bear or give birth, refers to the dead Haemon. Given that technon, or child, appears just 11 times in the entire play, it seems likely to me that the audience would notice this uptick in how often it appears as a reference to Haemon in particular after he has died. When Creon is talking to the living Haemon earlier in the play, he uses the word technon only in general gnomic statements about parents and children's proper relationships at verses 645 and 703. He doesn't use it as an endearment or a term of address to his son. And actually, the only character who uses it to refer to Haemon specifically, paradoxically enough, is Ismene, who at verse 568 asks Creon in disbelief whether he's really going to kill the bride of his own son. So she says, "Alaktenes nymphaea tu sau tu technu?" But the messenger reports that in Antigone's tomb, Creon directly addresses his son as Technon at verse 1230. Later, during the kamos, he bewails Haemon and his dead mother Eurydice together in the kind of apostrophe to the corpse that's typical of the lament. So Creon says, "Pheu, pheu, mater, athlia, pheu, technon," at line 1300. Creon expresses a kind of fatherly love for Haemon in death that we never heard from him while Haemon was alive. This is the second kamos in the play, and unfortunately, our podcast broadcast schedule skipped over the first kamos. At verses 801 to 882, Antigone has a lyric dialogue of her own with the chorus, in which she laments that she will die before she marries or has children or does any of the things that people expect to do as part of a full adult life. It's quite striking to me that in a play with 2 strong central characters, each of whom have a claim to be the hero of the play, both of these characters have a kamos. Sarah Nutter's terrific 2012 book, When Heroes Sing, Sophocles and the Shifting Soundscape of Tragedy, argues that lyric markers, like those found in a kamos, define Sophoclean heroes, both as heroes and as Sophoclean. But Nutter decided to omit the Antigone from her book because, as she says on page 24, quote, "both of its main characters," my emphasis, "use highly poeticized language when their other resources have run dry." Among the many other qualities that unite Antigone and Creon is the total bereavement and loneliness that emerges in their lyric dialogues with the chorus. By the end of the play, both Creon and Antigone have performed the lament for the dead that Creon forbade to the city of Thebes in the opening verses of the prologue of the play. This has been an amazing class, and I learned a lot from the students about teaching in general and podcasting in particular. For instance, I got to know each student a lot better and also differently than I normally would have as a result of the work that they did, first as Teacher of the Day and then in their podcast episode. Both Teacher of the Day and podcasting encourages each student to play to their own strengths, some of which I would never have found out about in more conventional kinds of assignments. In fact, some of our most enjoyable and effective class periods were the ones that were taught by students, and I guarantee 100% that if I'd asked the students their opinions about this for this episode, they would say the same thing. So my particular teaching skills and interests set the parameters for the course, but within those parameters, the kind of class that I tend to teach was just one of the threads in the fabric of how this course got woven together. And that made the course a way more interesting and fun experience for all of us. I think that is my favorite discovery of the semester about how podcasting changes not just the content, but the shape of a course for the better. Because students did so much of the actual teaching, our class was more like a band of colleagues than the teacher as leader who runs the show and the students as subordinates who execute instructions. In October, there was a period of about 3 weeks when so many students were doing their Teacher of the Day that I barely taught the class at all. This helped the students to get comfortable with asking each other difficult questions and working together as peers. So yeah, sure, before this course, I would have said that this always happens in my classes, and that's basically true. But because this class essentially taught itself for several weeks, at the exact point in the semester when an assortment of individual students tends to gel into a cohesive unity, these students were able to work together in groups so effectively that I regularly felt in the best possible way, like I was completely extraneous to their learning process. You've already heard from the students that they learned a lot about teaching from their podcast, and I surely did as well. This brings us to the end of Sophocles' Antigone in 2019. On behalf of my students and myself, this is Professor Deborah Beck thanking you for your interest in our podcast. We've really enjoyed it, and we hope that you have too.